This episode of the Packet Pushers podcast has been sponsored by OpenGear. OpenGear designs and manufactures next-generation console servers, intelligent cellular routers, and secure remote monitoring and management appliances that enable out-of-band access anywhere, anytime. OpenGear specializes in out-of-band solutions for the data center and remote locations utilizing secure cellular connectivity to ensure network uptime. Contact OpenGear to schedule a live demo to witness for yourself how awesome these products truly are. You can find OpenGear on the web at www.opengear.com or call them on 888-346-6853. OpenGear has a blog located at blog.opengear.com and you can find them on the Twitter as @OpenGear. And if you mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you contact OpenGear for a live demo, you will receive a free OpenGear t-shirt. The Packet Pushers would like to thank OpenGear for their support of our show and the community. Packet Pushers is supported partly by your donations. If you are able to, please consider making a donation to support us in producing the show. Other ways to help include telling your friends, your study groups, forums, and other people in the industry about us. If you are able to, please review the show on iTunes, which really helps us to find new listeners. We are always looking for topics and ideas and people to interview, so keep the feedback coming in by emailing us to packetpushers@gmail.com. And we'd especially welcome any vendors who would be interested in sponsoring or a show or advertising on our websites. Please contact us for details. Welcome to the Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get around the table to talk about life, workplace, and the technology in the data networking industry. This week, we are resuming the show of the future of Trill and part two, where the discussion continues on where we left off, where we shift from focusing on Trill in the data center to reinitiate the discussion around what happens in the campus. And then we go on for another 40 minutes, can you believe it, to talk more about Trill as it is. I'd like to thank John Hudson from Brocade and Andy Solomon from Cisco for taking their time to join me on the show and share their knowledge and their experiences around Trill so that we can all learn something from it and their contributions to the community. Thanks again to them. And I'll be back at the end of the show to say thanks for listening and remembering that too much networking would never be enough. But I think Trill's far more exciting in the campus. Because in the campus, you just start running more and more cables from point to point, and you just get more and more bandwidth. Whereas in the past, when you were building a good-sized campus, say you had a campus with 40 or 50 buildings on it, you would always just run your cables in a tree, sort of matching a spanning tree. And, you know, and that would sort of your data center was in the root of the tree, and then out you went with cables. But nowadays, we actually have traffic that goes all over the place across our networks, and we want to have east-west or, you know, around the world in a campus going right the way around the campus, not necessarily through the data center. And it's a lot easier to use Trill in a campus environment where, say, the distribution layer is hyper-connected to all the other switches in the distribution layer. Is that a reasonable statement?
Well, yeah, and I would add to that that's where part of the value will be in that, well, there's certainly still going to be optimal configurations and there's going to be efficient and inefficient operations. Mm-hmm. One of the values of Trill or even SPB, I mean, anything Trill-like, is essentially that you can't do you can't take a network down by plugging in the cable into the wrong place. You want to build loops and figure eights and dual rings and, you know, whatever you want to do, essentially the protocol will figure it out. Like I said, it may not be optimal for your application environment, but essentially it's ideal in a campus situation because you won't have an environment where someone plugging in a hub or something will end up taking out your whole network.
So I think it's more of a look at it from requirements. The reason I'm seeing people doing this is honestly, extending L2 because of virtualization, right? Where every VLAN has to be everywhere, or a VLAN has to be available on two sides of the data center, and frankly, you can't connect them via SDP because A, you don't have the cabling the way that way to begin with, and B, you're terrified of the loops, right? So then you do something like Trill to connect the east-west thing so that every VLAN can be everywhere at every time, and then you pray. I mean, you pray because all types of other things can happen that can cause you issues. But I don't want to get involved into L2 topology
No, but you know, but you're dead right. And essentially, it's been kind of a funny thing in that you've had there's been a lot of technologies that are now being dragged along with virtualization that were not designed for virtualization. Trill's a great example of that. And essentially, you know, what's really driving a lot of these environments is exactly what you said. How do we create one large, essentially, you know, several large flat networks layered on top of each other so that you have the maximum domain of possible hypervisors to move your VM to. And so right. That ends up driving a lot of that behavior. And I personally find it interesting because essentially what you have is you have the very passionate desire to be able to let your VMs kind of, you know, roam the data center like free range cattle, like looking for greener grass somewhere. And essentially as a result, we've been taking a lot of really good tried and true data center methodologies and throwing them out the window. It's huge layer two, putting all your VMs on one LUN. You know, there's all these, you know, very basic things that we've all been taught not to do that people are now doing because of the fact that they desperately want to be able to create these huge green pastures for their VMs to roam. And if they have a bunch of routing set up and, you know, all the VMs can do is move between hypervisors in the same rack, they don't have free range VMs. They have, you know, VM veal.
Wow. Well, so what we're talking about is organic VMs. We should yep. coin that phrase. Well, and actually, it becomes even a more challenging prospect because some of the reasons that you're extending those L2s are so that your VMs are reachable. But the other reason is because hypervisor vendors and actually storage vendors and some other folks out there feel that they have to have their machines L2 connected for fault tolerance, for example, from VMware or for vMotions for VMware, right? They expect even certain vendors are telling that their network attached storage has to be L2 connected to the machines that are running them, right?
So, yeah, so what does that when cause? You route, it adds latency to the packet, so you should only right. switch it. Yeah, I've heard that one from a couple of mm-hmm. storage vendors who really should know better.
And frankly, I've had arguments with some of them here, but here's the issue. The issue is that those are the things that are driving your data center requirements, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the network architect gets this piece of paper, goes, make everything L2 adjacent, talk to you later, bye, and everybody walks away.
And you have to make it work.
Exactly.
Yep.
So the weird thing is I'm seeing more, and I'm using FabricPath as an example, but it's Trill at the end of the day, right? I'm seeing Trill to be used inside a single data center much more often now in the production environments than I'm seeing yeah. between data centers. And that's just so that, you know, they can extend their L2 to 40,000 servers. You know, yeah. when you look at those numbers, you go, what in God's name are you thinking? But
no.
that's the requirements that are driving network designs now are so bizarre in that L2 can be anywhere. So
there's a question I have about that scenario where you've got Trill running across a big data center just so that you've got that L2 everywhere. I faced that challenge too. You know, in the traditional design before Trill, you would just take, you know, a big 802.1Q trunk and just pump every VLAN into every rack, but everything's still got to come back down to your core switches or an aggregation layer at least. So everybody's got to go down the tree and then back up to get to a different rack where that other host is that you might be trying to communicate with. So if you've got guys that are going to do a big Trill deployment today, are they running a full mesh from top of rack switches, rack to rack to rack to rack everywhere to
yes.
facilitate that straight line?
Yes, and the reason for that from my perspective is that if you had it from a trunking, the way you were talking about, if you have any kind of redundancy built in, then you're going to be blocking on half those ports, right, or even more.
Well, exactly. Right. Well, spanning tree for sure. That's exactly right.
Right. So what Trill does is allows you to be forwarding on all of those and actually load balancing across all of those, and that's the beauty of Trill for that kind of an environment, right?
I mean, because otherwise, interesting from a cabling perspective, just from a physical plant where you usually would have IDFs going to MDFs, kind of a great big hub and spoke, a big star of cables. You know, I'd be interested to see how some of these cabling plants look where you've got effectively every rack needing to talk to every other one.
Think of a honeycomb. You're basically the whole idea of fat trees are you know, they may still be useful in certain environments, but they're no longer going to be required. Yeah. And so essentially you're going to be able to create these large mesh. Now keep in mind too that we're still at the infancy of a lot of this stuff, right? So essentially today you still have a lot of environments where the switches that are running Trill don't have either a full or a lot of routing capabilities. That's going to change in the future, right? So eventually you're going to get to a point where essentially a single switch, a single R bridge is still going to be able to do at least the minimalistic routing of between VLANs. And so then you're going to get to a point where you're going to have these mesh networks with a routing overlay that allows for cross VLAN communication. And then you're not going to have all this traffic going to an aggregation or core just to get from one VLAN to another.
Although that brings me to one of my challenges on today's design with a Trill network, which is very much, where is your first hop redundancy protocol living, right? So where is your HSRP, VRRP living in that network? So if I have, if you think of it of a triangle, so let's simplify this, right? Think of a triangle, and at the point of the triangle, there are two switches at each point, right? Which is normal design, right? You would have dual connected stuff.
Yep.
Well, in a regular spanning tree environment, one of those points would have each one of those points would have their own HSRP group for those VLANs that are connected right there, right? But now we're talking about a triangle where those VLANs exist everywhere, but you still have to get off your local VLAN to go to the next VLAN, which may actually be on the same physical machine. But what are we doing, right? So there's that traffic trombone thing, or you're doing some form of blocking for the HSRP or VRRP protocol so it doesn't get on the wire past your local segment and things like that.
Yep. No, and that's why I say some of the stuff's still in the beginning, because essentially, you know, especially as you start stretching that out to multiple data centers, you essentially have to get to the point where you almost have, you know, virtual gateways that pay attention to source request and actually filter and pay attention to their adjacencies and essentially, you know, create this illusion of a default router, a default gateway, but it actually ends up being a distributed model.
Yeah, and John, that was the one solution I saw, or one of the ones to address that problem, so that you don't end up with a whole bunch of inter-VLAN traffic heading down the same path and losing the benefit of ECMP. You make R bridges act as the default gateways, and whoever your nearest R bridge is, he'll be your default gateway, and they'll take care of the rewriting for that.
Right, exactly. But that requires you to rewrite that protocol, because the thing about it is, a VM in motion is not going to re-ARP for the MAC address of the default gateway, right? So now you have the same MAC address, or you have R bridges in the three points of the triangle replying to that same MAC address, right?
Well, but I mean,
let me just finish the spot. Yeah. And then it gets into a little more complex thing when you get into things like multicast, where you have to have a designated router on a particular VLAN for forwarding and things like that. Then you can get into real complex design issues.
Well, I mean, you can take any good idea, add multicast, and it goes to hell in a handbasket. unfortunately, multicast won't go away as much as I hoped it would. You're right. There are other ways of doing it. I mean, we've seen this sort of challenge with load balancers in the late 90s moving forward, where, you know, how do you, you know, can you use gratuitous ARPs? Can you, you know, manipulate your ARP cache? You know, what can you do to start addressing some of these challenges of essentially taking something like a MAC address that was never designed to move? I mean, we're essentially doing things that we would never do. 10 years ago, can you imagine if you'd gone to a group of guys 10 years ago and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to take this operating system, right? And we're going to fling it across the data center, and then we're going to fling it across the state or the province. I mean, we're doing crazy things here that people really never intended this stuff to do. And so as a result, you have to start looking at things in very, very different ways, like, virtual gateways and, setting almost like setting a TTL on your ARP cache. Like you can tune it down with DNS, basically saying, okay, we're going to tell people don't trust your ARP cache more than 30 minutes.
I take your point about the default gateway, so the layer 3, whether we use VRRP or HSRP to locate. And what you're effectively saying is the default gateway might be on the left side of the data center, but your VLAN is actually on the right-hand side. And therefore, to get to the default gateway, you have to find the active VRRP exactly. master, cross the data center to get to it, and then it might route you back to where you came from. But I think,
And think about it that way. On a VMware environment, right, and you have two VMs sitting on that physical server, you may be bouncing across the whole data center back and forth,
sure.
just so talk to those two machines to speak to each other.
And right? that's the trombone yep. problem. But the flip side of that is that in one day in the future when VMware grows up and gets a pair, we're actually going to have a decent virtual switch in their operating system that does things. And this brings me back to a point that John made in a passing comment much earlier, was that he was saying that the vSwitch inside of the virtualization platforms could run Trill themselves. And actually yep. connect directly to a Trill core, and then the whole default gateway issue, that tromboning becomes less of a problem because it would always route to the shortest path to the default gateway wherever it sits within the Arbridge edge.
Yep, yep. No, and essentially there's an interesting, I wouldn't call it a war, but there's an interesting divergence of belief that's happening right now in the marketplace, in that there are some people that believe that your vSwitch should be this very passive thing that essentially turns all of its control over to a top of rack switch via a VEPA type, configuration. And you have people that believe that essentially the vSwitch needs to be given more intelligence and more knowledge and more control so that it can actually help more and become a more active participant in what's going on. And as far as which one's right, I think there's pros and cons to each, and we'll kind of let the market see where they think it should go.
What you're referring to there is things like VXLAN running overlays, or Nasira's proprietary GRE implementation of their software switch running
yep.
using a proprietary layer 3 overlay, or Microsoft with their NVGRE, and
yep.
the virtual network is completely isolated. What happens inside the virtual stuff is completely isolated from the networking. It's invisible to us.
Yep.
And that's an interesting discussion.
Yeah, no, agreed. And you have, and even there, you have between the VXLAN guys and the NVGRE guys, you have a bit of a conflict going on. And then there's a lot of other good technologies that could be reused. I was talking to one group a while ago about, doing some sort of a BGP type thing inside the hypervisor. We've looked at, the good thing is there's a lot of smart folk looking at all these problems from very different angles.
Yep.
It should be really interesting to see how it rolls out.
Well, I'm still very keen to see EVB and VEPA get to the point where it's comprehensible. I mean, I've just been researching that some more, where an intelligent vSwitch could interrogate, can actually communicate with the network and request permission and resources using an S-channel, right? And that, I think, is ultimately – now, this doesn't obviate the use of overlay networks, but it enhances them because those overlays can now start requesting status information from the network before making decisions about their forwarding.
It's the return of RSVP.
I won't argue with you,
Andy. I mean, it is true, right? But the flip side of it is we've got the current random, disorganization, chaotic implementation that the current dumb vSwitches are giving us, which is traffic goes wherever it goes and the network just has to over-engineer to cope with any stupidity that might accidentally happen in the application layers. What can we do to make this more, how are we going to make it smarter,
Yeah, that's why you have companies like Nasira popping up and Big Switch popping up. That's why you saw IBM release their own vSwitch, 2 weeks ago?
This was one forever, right? I mean, we've had the next
that's right.
So, and you have VMware actually pushing really hard to add features. But, I mean, even in some of these companies, you have differences of opinion. There are people within VMware that feel that the VDS should essentially grow significantly and get a lot more features. And you have other people that feel that it's better to, pass that off to someone like Cisco with the 1000V. And you have other people that would prefer to just lobotomize the vSwitch and essentially let your top of rack switch do everything and just use the vSwitch as a slave to the top of rack switch.
All right, let's stop talking about the Trill, data center. I'm starting to get bored.
Here's Trill to save us from that, right? Mm-hmm. Because you'd localize the L2SDB.
That's right. And there's one other thing that I talk about a lot, and I'm going to return to it here, is I've talked in previous shows about the cabling requirements for your data center and your campus are going to change drastically, right? Our current cabling architectures and our tools and the designs for cabling also map into a spanning tree within the data center. That is, all your cables follow a pathway. They go to the top of the rack. The top of the rack goes to a core, and then the core cabling infrastructure sits right next to the core switches. In the future, that's right, that cabling infrastructure will be different. So when you go to cable your data center today, do not my broad recommendation is do not flood cable your data center. Don't go around to every rack and put 16 fiber optics and 20 coppers. Just go and get a modular cabling system which you click-clack, and then everything's a patch lead. And if it's a 90-meter patch lead that you run from the top of rack 1 to rack 29 over there, then that's what it is. You don't use structured cabling anymore in your data center. That would be my
recommendation. It's a really good point because, I mean, it's been a couple of years since I've had to lay out a physical data center. And if I had to do that today with everything that's going on, I think I'd end up just drinking a lot. The number of changes that are coming would make it so difficult to essentially know if you're trying to build a data center that's supposed to still be relevant in 5 years. How you do that sort of thing. Because, I mean, you're dead on. I mean, this whole concept, I mean, you're still going to see trees in certain environments where it's beneficial, but this whole concept of these hierarchical, physical, you can almost tell the direction of traffic by seeing how the cables are laid out.
Yeah.
that whole model is going away. And that's right. But how fast and in what way and what that looks like.
Electricity is different because electricity is a bus. Right?
Yep.
Right. So you don't have the same problems. Your electricity is not a point-to-point system. It's a big fat bus, and then it's distributed down like a tree. But that's because it's bidirectional, and it's a potential, it's a different thing. So don't get electrical cabling mixed up with data cabling. Just a broad recommendation in the data center today is don't buy any cabling you don't absolutely need,
Yeah.
Because it's all going to be different tomorrow.
I've become a very big fan of a fabric extender. I mean, I know it's a Cisco thing that I'm talking about here, and yeah. I'm not trying to do that. But I've become a very big fan of using the top of rack fabric extenders. I think from a perspective of cabling and manageability, I really like it. And I don't want to get into marketing that stuff here, but from the cabling perspective and the way it all works together, I think it's an interesting idea.
Hmm. No, I mean I agree. I mean I think that when I started doing this, you didn't even have top of rack. You ran a couple hundred meters of copper to a Cat 5500 in the corner of the lab, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, patch panels were that was exciting, right? And then, unfortunately, by buying patch panels, we let people think that we'd install separate switches in every top of rack, and whoa, look what happened. So, essentially, going back to a model where you have a patch panel type construct that maybe is a little smarter than the patch panel, right? Something like the what you're talking about, I've seen a couple other vendors do sort of things. At Brocade, we have it's like a virtual top of rack type thing.
Yeah, I'm not going to get lost in a cabling discussion, but if you go to one of the vendor shows, they have these amazingly modular cables.
Exactly.
Systems. You buy a bit of this and a bit of that, and you clip it all together, and you've got yourself a structured cabling system. But when you want to tear that rack down in 2 years' time, because you've replaced your HPG 7s with your HPG 8s, or your UCSB B series now needs to be a Z series, or whatever it is, you need to be able to take that cabling and throw it away, and not sit there and go, we'd have to rerun an entire cable run, and that's going to cost $50,000, and you shouldn't do that. It should be modular. Anyway,
the cabling is more expensive than the network gear, believe it or not.
But most people don't see it that way because they see it as a one-time operation. You do it once, and that's no longer true. I want to jump off to the topic about where Trill should be used in the carrier, because I broadly have the view at the moment that it probably isn't going to work in the carrier space. But I think, John, you said carriers want it or can see a use for it.
Well, I got to be honest. I mean, I was surprised. I mean, I really, I'm not one of these people that thinks that the whole Trill SPB thing's like Highlander, where someone must lose their head and only one can survive. I really saw, because there's been a lot of cross-learning, right? There's been a lot of things that SPB has taken from Trill and things that Trill has taken from SPB over time. So they've kind of evolved in a kind of cool parallel way. And I really thought you'd see that division like you see in OSPF and ISIS. And I don't know if it's because of the amount of, you know, marketing that Cisco and Brocade have been doing. I don't know if it's because of the amount of environments that are running Fabric Path. I don't know if it's because of the delays in getting SPB standardized. I have no idea what the cause of it is.
Ultimately, we've only got a handful of silicon vendors today, and that's not necessarily the networking vendors. So the people who make silicon will be now applying more pressure to standards than ever before because it's a much narrower focus than it used to be.
Yep. And as a result, I've had four different IXs, right? So inter exchange points in Europe. Essentially, either I've gone out to visit them or they've come out to California to visit me, and they want Trill for their distribution layer.
Sounds like it to me. I mean, I've seen these guys because we run 10 gig all over the place, 10 gig Ethernet.
Oh yeah, no. You have these huge inter meshes, and they don't want them to be overly complicated. They don't want to have to manage them. They want them to just work. And today they're running Spanning Tree there, and it's freaking them out, right? And so you can almost look at to ask the question, where do you see something like Trill or a Trill based product, finding a niche? And I would almost say, anywhere that you find Spanning Tree, right? I mean, essentially, anywhere that Spanning Tree is heavily used is an opportunity to, remove pain and implement something like Trill.
And the beauty of that, and even from a service provider perspective, is it's simple. It's simple to configure.
Yes.
And that's the beauty. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of people like Trill and even, again, back to the Brocade and Cisco thing, and like our implementations, I mean, gosh, I can get Fabric Path running in four commands.
Is the number of devices that everyone's being asked to manage, the complexity? I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, if someone said they were managing, 50 servers or 100 switches, it was something that they could actually brag about. And now if you look at vSwitches and top of rack switches and core and aggregation and servers and VMs and blades and iPads and iPhones and all this stuff. I mean, the number of devices involved are scaling exponentially. The number of humans that are in these groups to manage it is not. And so the only way
I'll pop a foo-foo valve if you. Yeah. So once upon a time we had a web server and a MySQL server and we put it on one box and then we scaled horizontally. Nowadays we have to have seven servers to do that. One's a load balancer.
Well, we started this section of the show talking about shouldn't be used in the carrier space, and we kind of got off into how it could be used. But Greg, you were saying took a broad view that. No, I don't think it's going to work. And I was curious why you didn't think it fit, because in my mind I was thinking of places that it did fit, but you were thinking, no.
Trill's got no OAM and no feedback. So you just plug it in and it works, sure, but it doesn't have any configuration or monitoring stuff that necessarily can feed into a sort of like a monitoring and reporting system. It's got fairly limited set of debugging capabilities to tell you where something went wrong, which is either a strength or a weakness, depending on how you're going. So most of the carriers, these protocols, they're used to protocols like SDN, SDH, which have multiple layers of signaling end-to-end and inherently feature-rich for diagnostic and reporting capabilities. Trill has none of that, and that's why I'm dubious.
And you're essentially, what you're seeing is, just to be very honest, is it's a list of priorities, right? Hmm. Getting things like, the header done were kind of a higher priority. And so what you've seen now is a push. Essentially what we all agreed upon in, I think it was Prague, was that the focus right now has to be, is OAM. And essentially multi-path, multicast type features to kind of get us to a feature parity. So there are actually three different drafts right now going through on OAM. One of them more BSD BFD based. One of them more based on the ICMP stuff that you've seen in the past, and a third one as well. And so you're dead on. I mean, there essentially has been a serious lack of OAM in Trill, and that's going to change a lot over the next year. And so hopefully we'll get a lot of feedback.
Well, then if that comes out, then we will see. But the SPBM, shortest path bridging.
Oh yeah,
came with bog heaps of that, and If you listen back to show 44 where we talked about that, you know, it didn't just come. It came with knobs and switches and dials and, you know, big levers where you can change the way, you know, and all that, and little red lights that flash on and off when things aren't quite right. So that was why I thought SPBM was going to be far more successful for carriers. And because SPBM has a different frame format, which doesn't necessarily mean that you should replace all the switches in the path. It is legacy compatible, provided your MTU size, Ethernet MTU size, can cope with it.
That
makes a compelling story at the carrier side, right? If they can hang on to those 25-year-old assets in the core of the network, those buggers will, instead of giving us a decent service. Lousy buggers.
Right. Actually, it's funny.
All our carrier listeners just got upset again, Greg.
there was just a new OEM draft published from two guys over at Cisco for doing what they're calling proactive OEM. So now there are four different OEM drafts going on in Trill. So there's going to be stuff coming, but you're dead on. The SPB guys did a lot of great work very early on.
Hopefully, one of them will actually work.
Hmm. Yep. No. I was telling someone the other day, you know, the last 3-4 years, networking has been exciting, man. It's like there's all sorts of really cool stuff coming out. I mean,
as I've said to people in the past, we've had 10 years of networking largely being static. Back 2001, we pretty much nailed everything. And 10 years later, we've managed to – like, seriously, we haven't had a new routing protocol. We haven't had a new switching protocol. We've had crossbar fabric since 1998. But we didn't need anything more because we'd solved all the networking problems right the way up until about 2007 when VMware took off.
And VMware VMware has done some silly stuff for networking, but it's helped networking enormously. And frankly, the storage industry recently as well, all the replication. I mean, I cannot tell you what all the replication, the amount of data that's putting on your network and on your WAN and all the things that causes you to have to do.
Yeah.
So, John, I mean, we've had a great conversation about Trill here, a long one, and got way off on some various rabbit trails and different things. It's been an absolutely great conversation. Now, I know there's going to be some folks listening to this podcast that are going, okay, I missed good parts of what they were saying just because I haven't had a chance to read about Trill. So if someone wants to sit and learn about Trill and understand why it's being proposed as a successor to STP and so on, where should they start? I mean, there are RFCs they should read, other documents you would recommend?
Well, I mean, essentially, I always encourage people to get involved in the IETF. The IETF, unlike other standards bodies, is kind of more of a club. So essentially, anyone can sign up for the mail list. They can come to the meetings. We're going to be in Paris in 3 weeks. We're going to be through North America for the next 2 or 3 sessions. So come to a meeting, go to the IETF website, read the drafts. But the drafts are not the most kind of human-friendly, lovely things in the world. So if you do some searches on Google for like Nanog Trill, there's been some great discussions in Nanog on not only just Trill versus SPB, but the Trill protocol itself. In the IP journal that Cisco puts out, there was a lovely Trill tutorial that Radia and Donald created a couple months ago. And certainly, you can certainly reach out to both Cisco and Brocade. We're both doing a lot of Trill training around the place, and I'm more than happy to send people out the presentation I did at the Ethernet Carrier World in Amsterdam a couple months ago. So, reach out, because I mean, essentially, for people that are interested, this is an amazing time, because essentially you're kind of at the ground floor of what could end up being a protocol that becomes very large over the next 10 years. And so, if you want to get involved, if you want to learn it now and even start getting involved in how it's evolving, now is the right time to do it. We're at the ground floor, and there's a lot of great work to be done.
Yeah, I can underscore what you were saying about Brocade helping people to get started with Trill in that. At a Tech Field Day event that I was able to attend in the fall, Brocade was one of the presenters, and we got a chance to do hands-on and build ourselves some R-bridges and put some links together. It was very informative.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it. But like I said, if you're curious, look out, because the truth of the matter is it's not too complicated yet. hopefully it'll stay that way, but it might not be in 10 years. So learn it now while it's still fresh.
Yes, it's easier. I've been tracking it since mid-2009. I've actually wrote my first article. There'll be a link in the show notes to all the links that we've talked about on today's podcast, and you'll find them there. Andy, thanks so much for joining us on the show this week. Would you like to tell us about what you're going to be doing this week and where we can find you?
Well, thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun, actually. More fun than I even expected, which is pretty cool.
The virtual workbench is a fun place to be.
You know, it's a good way of spending a Sunday afternoon, I have to tell you. You can probably find me at Networkers. I usually do a data center data center 3.0 presentation. This year there will be something on FabricPath in there as well, which is, again, the Cisco pre-Trill, pre-standards implementation, something that I'm very interested in and I've worked with a lot. Otherwise, just find me on Twitter at @asolomon or send me an email. It's just the way you would spell my name at cisco.com.
Fantastic. And John, thanks so much for your time joining us on the show. Where can people find you?
So they can actually, I'm on Twitter as well at The Socialist with an underscore. And certainly I welcome people to read my blog on ethernetfabric.com. And then certainly anyone is more than welcome to shoot me an email at john.hudson@brocade.com or gmail.com. One of my jobs is to spread and teach the good word of Trill. I'm happy to help people out wherever I can.
Fantastic. And Mr. Banks, what are you going to be doing this week?
Well, sadly, I will be reviewing all of the different offices that I support. I'm one of those. It's just me and another guy that manage a network for the company that we're at.
Oh, you actually work for a living.
Yeah, sadly, yes. But I'll be building bigger spanning trees, unfortunately. That is my lot in life for the time being until this brave new world comes to fruition. And you can hear me tweet about it at EC Banks. And, of course, I blog up at packetpushers.net.
Okay, and so, of course, that is the show for this week, and thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. Of course, I'm Greg Ferro. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. You can find the show and all about the show and the links, and they are on the website at packetpushers.net. If you've got the time, you can always chuck us a cup of coffee via a donation. We do appreciate it if you can. The show takes a lot of time and a lot of energy, and the odd donation for a cup of coffee makes life twice as sweet for those of us who get it. So do that. Sign up for the Packet Pusher Supporters, which is an email list where we occasionally, and I mean very occasionally, typically once a quarter, send you an email to talk about some of the things that we've been doing, like the Packet Pushers Packet Party, which we had last week, which was hellishly good fun, and we will get to you very, very soon. We'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you are thinking. Alternatively, keep an eye on the website, leave comments on the blog post associated with this, and follow us on the Twitter as @packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.
Is it?
Yep. It's over an hour now. We've been here for an hour and 15 minutes. An hour and 18 minutes. Yeah.
And good conversation.
Yeah. I love these conversations. I live to record these nerdy shows. I mean, we've got to do a virtual whiteboard again soon, Ethan, where we all get around and chew the fat. But these shows are when we set out to do Packet Pushers, we said we're going to keep it nerdy. It's got to be high class, high end, because it's not. There's no fun in sitting around chatting around. 7-layer model sessions.
Yeah.
Right?
No, I mean. there are a lot of – I'm amazed how many times I run into people at conferences and so forth where it's one guy or two guys managing this whole network all by themselves, and they never have a chance to have these conversations, right?
Yeah.
So it's good stuff.